I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today on Midday, WYPR reporters Emily Sullivan, John Lee, and Sarah Y. Kim bring us insight into the latest local news from the Scott administration in Baltimore City confronting the challenges of COVID-19, appointees to key positions, and changes to the way the Board of Estimates does business. And in Baltimore County, as students and teachers head back to school buildings, the system still struggles to recover from last year's ransomware attack. Plus, inequities in access to coronavirus vaccines abound for people of color and people with disabilities. What plans are in place to address the imbalance? Members of the WYPR news team join me after these headlines. Thanks, Andy, and thanks to everybody who has made a pledge in this first day of our spring membership campaign. We very much appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Before we get underway, a shout out to the terrific folks at the Baltimore Museum of Industry. We had a great time on Saturday night at their virtual bull and oyster roast. We had a really, really good time, and we raised some money for the BMI's education program. So thanks to everybody who joined us for that event, and thanks to the staff of the BMI for putting together such a terrific time. The United States Senate was busy on Saturday as well. They passed the American Rescue Plan after 27 hours of debate and the longest vote in Senate history. It's a big sweeping bill that includes stimulus checks, unemployment subsidies, enhanced child tax credits, funds for schools and local jurisdictions, and money to shore up the ACA. The House is expected to vote on the bill tomorrow. It is likely to pass and become President Joe Biden's first major legislative victory. Today on Midday, we're going to turn our focus to local news with members of the WYPR news team. I will speak to three of my colleagues about what they're covering on their respective beats. A little bit later, I'll check in with Baltimore County reporter John Lee and our health and housing reporter, Sarah Y. Kim. But we begin today with Emily Sullivan, who covers Baltimore City government and local politics. Hey, Emily, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. It's good to be here.
So good to have you. I want to talk about a couple of folks appointments that the Brandon Scott administration is in the process of seeing through. The first one's a pretty easy one. It's Jim Shea. He is currently the acting city solicitor, but I guess he will be the official city solicitor in the not too distant future.
Definitely not. So Mayor Scott identified him in December to be his pick for the city's top lawyer. And the city council has been, you know, having a series of hearings to vote on whether or not they're going to approve him. And so far, unanimously, he's received support from the entire council. He was an interesting pick. He was chairman emeritus of Venable LLP, which is Maryland's largest law firm. So his supporters think he kind of brings an air of professionalism to City Hall. And he is up on second reader approval before the council tonight, meaning I would say within the next month or so, he'll be officially confirmed once he passes third reader.
Yeah, things take a little while in city government and in government.
Yes,
all
do.
The times. Yeah. Of course, he was a candidate for governor as well in the Democratic primary, and one Brandon Scott was his lieutenant governor candidate. I also want to ask you about the situation with the head of the Department of Public Works. I did ask the mayor about this when he was on Midday last week. And, you know, the search for this person to lead the DPW has been going on for quite a while. You know, Mr. Scott was, you know, the victor in the June primary. It was a pretty solid bet that he was going to end up the mayor come December. And then in November, he wins officially the general election. And one assumes that from that moment on, the beginning of November, he started looking for a DPW director. Here we are in March, and we still don't have one. What's going on that score?
So the latest update there is that Scott has asked the city council to approve a salary boost for the DPW head. Acting DPW director Matthew Garbar currently nets $188,000 per year, and the mayor is asking that the city council approve a bump up to $245,000 a year. And during his requests, he presented a salary study that the city commissioned. And basically, cities of similar sizes to Baltimore, A, they generally divide the responsibilities that the DPW had performed. So Baltimore's DPW head does basically three jobs total compared to counterparts in DC and Philly. And the DPW head is underpaid. So the hope is that by funneling more money into the salary, the city can attract some more, you know, more qualified candidates. The interesting thing there, Tom, is as most listeners know, the city has a crumbling water infrastructure. It's ancient. It's in terrible need of repairs. So the city is really looking for someone with strong experience with outdated systems. The last I've heard, there, you know, is no one final candidate the city is trying to approve. The hope is that a boosted salary can make the process a little bit easier.
Yeah, let's just hope it makes the process a little bit quicker, because it's time for somebody to take the reins over there and get stuff together. That's interesting. So I guess most other jurisdictions or many other cities divide up the job of the DPW. I mean, the DPW head here is in charge of solid waste, in charge of water, runs a pretty big department, a big budget, but they divvy it up differently in other places. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, that's correct. And Matthew Garber, he does have deputies. You know, there is a head of solid waste, but the title's not director. So ultimately, Garber, of course, is, you know, kind of responsible for every single thing. But generally, teams in other cities do have more senior leadership. And again, those senior leaders are better paid. So I think that this proposal is really interesting. And Scott has argued that it's part of modernizing city government, right? Getting it up to speed with the ways that other similar sized cities are functioning. And again, you know, no final candidate, as far as I know, has been identified yet, but the search does continue. And as you mentioned, it's been a long time. Rudy Chow, the former DPW head, announced his retirement more than a year ago. So we have not had someone in a permanent capacity in here since the Young administration.
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guests today are three of my colleagues here at WIPR. We're looking a bit behind the headlines for some of the stories that they have been covering. We are speaking right now with Emily Sullivan, who covers City Hall and all things Baltimore politics. Emily, there's this new program to try to track down and get a handle on illegal guns that come into the city. You know, of course, we have a terrible problem with continuing problem with violent crime, murders, non-fatal shootings. The non-fatal shootings, we've got 16 more of those to date than we did last year at this time. So there's no shortage of guns on the streets, nor are there shortages of instances of people using them. But tell us about this pilot program, I guess, from an organization called Every Town for Gun Safety.
Yeah, so first let's start by taking a closer look at the problem itself. So there were about 2,500 firearms seized in Baltimore last year. 82% of those weapons were originated from outside of the city, and 63% from outside Maryland altogether. So the city has a terrible gun trafficking problem. And of course, those guns are then used in illegal and violent crime that just destroys the city. So Every Town for Gun Safety, which is this nonprofit that was founded and is largely financed by Michael Bloomberg, they offered Baltimore a software program. It's a pilot, so Baltimore is going to be the first city using it. And what this program does is use public databases to kind of just track how these guns move. So the concept is that police can, you know, work with a gun they pulled from a scene, scan its serial number, scan all the information they have about it, and kind of trace that gun from owner to owner. And so the idea here is to track the movement of guns to establish a pattern, right? A pattern of gun trafficking. And what that looks like would be identifying entities that frequently sell guns that end up in Baltimore and the crimes here, such as gun shows, such as individual dealers, and straw purchasers also, who, you know, are people who buy guns on behalf of others who are banned from owning them. This program is supposed to kick off next month, so it'll be a while, you know, before we get any data that we can look at. But Scott is optimistic. Baltimore Police Commissioner Michael Harrison is optimistic. And I think this is a really good example, Tom, of a program that is, you know, it's the first of its kind, but it's kind of a surprise that no other cities have used anything like this before, right? So the Baltimore Police Department will be watching, you know, with bated breath to see how this goes, but many other departments throughout the country will be as well.
The mayor's office, according to the reporting you've done on this, noted that 2,500 plus weapons were seized in Baltimore last year. 82%, as you say, came from outside the city. They're coming from places like Virginia and Tennessee and elsewhere. Where is the software going to grab its data from? What information are they going to be able to assemble and make readily available to the police department and to others in city government? How are they going to find the facts that they need to look closely at to figure out how to skin this particular apple?
Right. And quickly, you bring up a good point by listing the names of the states the guns tend to originate from. They are coming generally from southern states with much more relaxed gun control laws than Maryland. So this program plans to analyze data, from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms e-trace system. This is a program that collects information about gun movements from different law enforcement agencies. So it'll have federal data, and it will also analyze ballistic evidence and data from ShotSpotter, which is Baltimore's gunshot detection network, and local BPD records that, you know, identify what weapons were used and what crimes. So there's going to be a patchwork of databases this program's going to be using.
Both Nick Mosby, the president of the city council, and Bill Henry, the comptroller, who were all elected in the same election as Brandon Scott, the mayor, have both, Mr. Henry and Mr. Mosby, have both sought to restructure their parts of city government in the way that Brandon Scott is trying to restructure the executive branch. Talk about some of the things that Council President Mosby is trying to do.
Sure. So as city council president, Nick Mosby is able to govern over the city council. So one of the things he did immediately, as soon as he was sworn in, was divide the amount of committees in half. He restructured committees, which are the people responsible for kind of workshopping and tweaking legislation to make sure that it's legal, to make sure it can accomplish what it's actually setting out to accomplish. He tweaked those committees so that there are more people on them. And the idea there is that, you know, the more council members working on each bill, the more democratic the process is. He has, you know, the council so far has definitely focused on pandemic relief legislation. The first bill we saw pass this term was something that would cut third-party delivery service fees for restaurants. And the council is continuing to introduce legislation for relief tonight, too. And Comptroller Henry, the other week he introduced a series of bills to bring the office into the 21st century, which listeners may remember was kind of his campaign promise. His office was previously occupied by Joan Pratt for over 25 years. And so some of the bills that he introduced the previous council meeting 2 weeks ago, one would require real estate records to be maintained on an online public database instead of, quote, a well-bound leather book. That was something that's in charter now that he's seeking to change. So Mosby, Henry, Scott, you know, as these three begin the first bit of their tenures in their new seats, we are seeing a ton of effort to modernize their respective offices, to push the campaign promises. And Henry, I should say, is planning on introducing even more bills at the next meeting. So we should be seeing the comptroller's office look pretty different relatively soon.
Here we are in the 21st year of the 21st century, finally getting around to, abandoning leather-bound books and putting databases online. Good for them. All right, Emily Sullivan, I very much appreciate all of your reporting on City Hall and Baltimore politics. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
Coming up, WYPR's John Lee will join us to talk about the latest news from Baltimore County. And before we speak with John, a word of thanks to everybody who has jumped right in on this day one of our spring pledge drive. Listener support is the single most important source of funding at WYPR. It allows us to bring you the news coverage that you've come to rely on from folks like Emily Sullivan and John Lee and Sarah Y. Kim. And it couldn't be easier to become a member. Here's Andy Beanstock to explain how.
It could not be any easier, Tom. Just visit WYPR.org, click the donate link.
Thanks, Andy, and thanks again to everybody who has stepped up so far in this first day of our spring membership campaign. We are very, very grateful. By the way, on deck tomorrow here on Midday, Dr. Letitia Geraza, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City. She will join me, and Anne Lamott, the best-selling author of 19 books, many of which are bestsellers, as I mentioned. Her latest book is a meditation on getting through tough times. It's called Dusk, Night, Dawn, on Revival and Courage. Anne Lamott will join me tomorrow here on Midday. Joining me now is another one of my great colleagues here at the WYPR news team. John Lee covers Baltimore County. Hey, John, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So let's talk about schools. Some of the kids in Baltimore County schools headed back to classrooms last week. How's that going so far?
Right. Well, the first phase started March 1st. You had pre-K through second graders coming in, and also disabled students at four schools for the disabled. What I've been hearing so far is that it's actually gone pretty well. Early indications were that about one-third of the students who could come back were coming back, because the students, their parents have the option that they remain on virtual learning. And so the way it's working in the county, and I don't think it's unusual, is that you have students coming into classrooms 2 days a week, and then the other 3 days they remain at home. And so this will be a continued phase-in of students. Next week they're going to have the next phase-in, the next group of students. These are students who are on IEPs, individualized education plans, also students in career and tech programs. And they'll keep phasing in students actually until April 6th. The week of April 6th will be the last group of county students who'll be back in classrooms if all goes as planned.
All right, so slow and steady. Meanwhile, the teachers' union, not completely pleased about any plan to get folks back into classrooms without being fully vaccinated. I understand they filed a restraining order. What's up with that?
That's right, they did. That restraining order has been rejected, according to the teachers union, but they continue to negotiate, I'm told. Checked actually before we came on the air this afternoon. Negotiations are continuing between the teachers union and the administration. And what they want is that teachers who have underlying medical issues, either they have it or someone who they live with, they would have the option to continue to just teach virtually. As it stands now, that is not the case, according to the teachers union. And so they're still working on it, but that, Tom, has been a real bone of contention. And you mentioned the vaccinations, that too. Interesting in that, because you can get vaccinated in various places, there's no way that the county school system says it knows who has been vaccinated as far as the teachers. So I think they're having kind of a hard time getting a handle on that. So a lot of that's still kind of bumpy. A lot of teachers still concerned. But then the flip side of that, though, and I was talking to some teachers last week on a story, those teachers were generally excited about being back in the classroom, and they said their kids were too. And that's been the story throughout this. You've had these two camps. You've had the ones who wanted to be back in classes yesterday, and you had the ones who were concerned about their safety, about their children's safety, and wanted to take it slow. And so now we're having this phase in, and not everyone's going to be happy, but as of now, from what I've heard so far, it's going pretty well.
And Superintendent of Schools Darrell Williams is scheduled to talk to the county council tomorrow. The school system, in addition to coping with COVID-19, has had quite a year. I mean, back in November, they had this horrible ransomware attack. And there are some folks who think that that hasn't even been fully resolved now. Where does that stand?
Well, that has been a real issue between the school system and county officials, in that the county officials from the county executive Olszewski on down feel like they have not heard nearly enough out of the school system about what's being done regarding the ransomware attack, how much money is being spent, where the criminal investigation is. They just feel like there are a lot of unanswered questions. What school superintendent Williams always says is that, hey, this is under investigation. I've been told I can't speak much about it. But the frustration was real, and that State Senator Chris West, for one, actually introduced legislation in the General Assembly to try to allow the county to get more control over the school system's finances, basically have sort of a carrot and stick situation, which is that we'll give you this money as long as you say, tell us what's been going on with the ransomware investigation. That legislation, Senator West withdrew it, so that's not happening. But you can, just from that, you can tell that there's been a lot of frustration. So when Superintendent Williams meets with the council tomorrow afternoon, should be interesting. I'm sure they'll be asking him about that, try to get what details they can. It'll be interesting to see what he tells them, and also just about the, in general, the reopening of the schools.
John Lee covers Baltimore County for us here at WIPR. He's part of our wonderful news team. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. And so, John, let's talk about the vaccine rollout in Baltimore County. Different jurisdictions are having different levels of success in that regard. Generally speaking, it would seem to me that, for example, that big mass vax site they have at the Timonian Fairgrounds has gotten some pretty rave reviews. I mean, generally speaking, I'm under the impression it's going pretty well in Baltimore County. How do you think it's being received?
That's my sense of it too, Tom. I've been out to the clinic in the Cow Palace there at the fairgrounds, and it seems very well run. I know a number of people who have gotten vaccinated there, and they've all said they had a really good experience of showing up there and in a matter of minutes working their way through. And then you have to wait, of course, 15 minutes once you get vaccinated, and then you leave. And in and out and done in 30 minutes or less. So they do seem to have a well-oiled machine out there, and they've made some accommodations for people who have difficulty walking. There's a whole area with push wheelchairs that they can help in golf carts. They can help people get down into the Cow Palace and through it. So I think the reviews have been pretty favorable. Even the governor paid a visit a couple of weeks ago, lauded it for being very, very well run. And last check this morning, about 11% of people in the county have received both doses before. But of course, Baltimore County is no different from other localities in the state, in that African Americans, the percentage of African Americans who have been vaccinated is far less than the white population. African Americans make up 30% of the population in the county, and they've so far 13% have been vaccinated. So the county this week is going to start a campaign to try to reach out to them more effectively. And health officer Dr. Gregory Branch told me late last week that he will start a program trying to get into the communities more effectively in a few weeks, opening smaller clinics in neighborhoods. He cited specifically Turner Station and Lansdowne as areas he is targeting, hopes to have a mobile van that he can kind of get into those neighborhoods. But what he told me, and we know this is true across the country, because the supply of vaccines is so low, he really can't get that up and running effectively probably for another 4 to 6 weeks as they wait for the vaccine supply to increase.
Yeah, and everybody says that at some point, you know, this supply-demand, proportion is going to change, and that there won't be a supply problem the way there currently is now. In our last couple of minutes here, John, I want to ask about the debate that the Baltimore County Council had concerning term limits. Came up, had some support, but I guess not enough to get it over the finish line.
No. The vote actually was 4-3 in favor of term limits, and it would have been held to 3 4-year terms. So the vote was 4-3, but you needed 5 because it's a charter amendment, and you have to have at least 5 votes on the 7-member council for that to happen. And you know, Tom, we've been talking about term limits off and on throughout in this country for it feels like decades now, and the arguments on either side have remained the same. You know, you have the group that wants term limits, and they say people should not be holding an office for, you know, decades and not allowing new people to get in there with fresh ideas, and turnover is good, and because of the way the voting is set up, it's hard to beat an incumbent because they have all the advantages of incumbency. But then you have the other side that says, you know, it's good to have veterans around. It's good to have people who know which end is up. And sometimes it takes a couple of terms just to get a sense of what the government's all about. And so if you suddenly start having term limits, then you're going to lose all of this knowledge. And also that there has been turnover on the county council over the years. And one or two members go here and there. And this coming year, just quickly, I would say that there's a real chance, we'll see what happens, but there's a real chance there could be turnover because we have several members who have been on the council for 3 terms now. We'll see whether they decide to go for a 4th. One has already said, Tom Quirk, he will not run for re-election next year.
And just real quickly, in the final seconds that we have, County Executive Johnny Olszewski Jr. Is getting ready to present his budget to the council. That's sometime in mid-April. The situation, how does it compare to last year's fiscal situation?
Should be much better. Last year, of course, was at the very beginning of the pandemic. They really didn't know what was about to hit them, but they knew it wasn't going to be good. And so they were making a lot of cuts and just sort of preparing for the worst. And you may remember, Tom, a year before that, Olszewski was dealing with a budget shortfall. So he said sort of 2 years in a row of gloom and doom budgets. This coming one will be interesting. My guess it'll be a bit better. The tax receipts seem to be better. There is money in the American Rescue Plan for local governments, so we'll see how much the county gets from that. So I think it looks like it's going to be better this year.
John Lee covers Baltimore County for us here at WYPR. Appreciate it, John. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up, the latest local housing and education news with WYPR's Sarah Y. Kim. But first, we want to take a minute to remind you that we have begun our spring membership drive. If you're not a member of WYPR, we would love to welcome you into the fold. Here's Andy Beanstock to tell you how you can make that happen.
Please just take the next minute or two, visit WYPR.org, click the donate link, and presto, you're a member of WYPR.
And welcome back. It is midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us on this first day of our spring membership campaign, today on Midday, we're touching base with 3 reporters from the WYPR news team. We turn now to Sarah Y. Kim, WYPR's health and housing reporter. Hey, Sarah, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for being here. So let's talk about a story that I think we're going to hear a little bit about later today, and that is COVID-19 vaccines for Marylanders with disabilities. What have you been working on in that regard?
Right. So I put out a piece last Friday about this, basically about all the barriers that Marylanders with disabilities face throughout the process, whether that's from getting an appointment to actually getting the shots in their arms. Now, currently, under phase 1B of the state's guidelines, all Marylanders with intellectual and developmental disabilities, they're eligible for the vaccine. But I spoke to several disability rights advocates with disabilities who've said that the state hasn't been doing enough to prioritize them. So for instance, when you're trying to make an appointment, that in itself is already a hurdle. For someone who's able-bodied, it's already a pretty complicated process. You have to navigate multiple websites. Often a lot of slots are not available due to short supply. What these advocates have been telling me is that a lot of these forms, they don't have ways of indicating your specific disability. If you have a rare disability, they might not be able to recognize it. Some people who are visually impaired or have intellectual disabilities may not be able to navigate all of the different steps of applying for the vaccination. So that in itself is already a huge hurdle. A lot of the sources I spoke to, they've now gotten their first dose, but it took them since January to basically early March or late February to get their vaccine. And basically, they were trying to navigate those multiple websites, trying to get those shots and not being able to get them, partially because of those hurdles. And then there's a whole other process when they have to get to the actual sites, right? You know, for someone who's able-bodied and can drive, they could just drive to a vaccination site, or they can potentially risk going on public transport. Someone who is immunocompromised and has a disability, it's a lot more difficult for them to come up with a smooth plan to get to a vaccination site. They might not be able to drive. Taking public transport may be too risky for them. If a site is not within walking distance, that's a huge difficulty for them. And some people may have to even turn to reject vaccine appointments because they get assigned to a site that they can't even get to. And there isn't much public-facing information, according to these advocates, about what resources are available when they get to the sites.
Yeah, it's a really complicated situation for folks who are contending with disabilities, because it's not just the difficulty of getting an appointment, which everybody is experiencing. But as you say, access to the sites themselves sometimes can be really, really tricky. Of course, this whole notion of racial inequities and inequities in general between those who are getting the vaccines, those who are not, is something that has been on a lot of people's minds. You've been covering this. The acting health secretary of the state of Maryland, Dennis Schrader, has been in front of lawmakers talking about this. He was at a meeting last week that you reported on, that there was clearly some frustration with Mr. Schrader and with the pace of the rollout for people of color here in Maryland in terms of their access to the vaccine. Where does that stand as we speak?
Right. So at last week's meeting, and these meetings happen every Monday at 4, they're available to the public. But at last week's meetings, tensions rose quite high, particularly because of Governor Larry Hogan's comments the week before that Baltimore had received more than its fair share of vaccines, essentially. And so there was a demand from Senator Mary Washington that, you know, the secretary apologize on behalf of the Hogan administration for making those comments. That aside, generally every week there has been sort of a recurring tension between the secretary and state lawmakers. You know, the secretary has said, we are trying to make an equitable distribution. We distribute to counties based on population. We have these anti-vaccine hesitancy campaigns. And ultimately, the issue is short supply. You know, everyone will get a dose eventually. What state senators are saying is that vaccine hesitancy is not, you know, it's an issue, but it's not the issue. And what we need to see more from the state is a centralized website that helps people apply for vaccines more easily, more transparency about data, about who is getting the vaccine and who isn't. And a lot of senators have said, you know, Secretary Schrader, you keep saying that there is vaccine hesitancy, that people don't want the vaccine, especially in counties like Prince George's, which are predominantly Black. But the reality is that people actually do want the vaccine. And why aren't they getting that vaccine? Why can't we get into those sites and establish those vaccine sites for these communities? And there seems to be a dissonance between the urgency that constituents feel and the frustrations they feel, and a sense from the secretary that, you know, we are doing the best we can. The vaccine disparity is not as significant an issue as it seems.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but a new poll from Goucher College, the Sarah T. Hughes Center for Politics, has, I think, about 68% of white Marylanders saying they want the vaccine, and 64% or something in that ballpark of Black residents saying they want the vaccine. So the difference between desire for the vaccine between the white and Black populations here in our state, not at all very wide. So for those folks making the argument that it's hesitancy or reluctance on the part of communities of color to get the vaccine, and that's causing the inequity, that doesn't seem to hold water, at least according to the poll that, you know, Malia Cromer and her crew out at Goucher have just released. The fact of the matter is, as you have reported, the three counties, the three jurisdictions in the state of Maryland with the largest black populations, Prince George's, Charles County, and then Baltimore City, they are the ones with the lowest vaccination rates. You reported about General Jeanine Birkhead, who leads the equity task force that the governor has put together. And she talked about mobile sites and those kinds of things. I mean, have you seen any, you know, appreciable progress in that kind of approach? I mean, are they going to be able to get these vaccines, just simply make them more accessible to communities of color throughout the state?
I think mobile sites are an important part of the strategy, but what we're seeing is that there aren't that many of those sites. There need to be more. And there is still this continuing sentiment from state lawmakers that we don't have enough of these sites, that we don't have enough people who are directly going into communities of color and making the vaccine easily physically accessible for them. Mass vaccination sites were supposed to be, for example, a part of the strategy to create a more equitable distribution. And yet a lot of people, you know, they can't necessarily take public transport to those sites. They can't easily walk to those sites who are in these vulnerable communities.
And Senator Jim Rosapep had an exchange with the acting secretary, Mr. Schrader, about this again on this issue of whether or not it's hesitancy and reluctance that's causing the paucity of people of color getting the vaccine or access itself. In that exchange, which I happened to see and you reported on, Mr. Rosapep and other leaders from Prince George's County and the city of Baltimore really have been quite dissatisfied with the way the state has been handling this and the lack of responsibility the state seems to be taking for it. Do you see any change in the horizon? Do you see anything shaken out that's going to appease the leaders here in the city and in places like Prince George's County?
The sense is that those frustrations haven't at all dwindled. They're the same. Every week they have the same concerns consistently throughout the vaccination process since December. One of the main frustrations that lawmakers had is that Maryland has been consistently behind most of the states in getting vaccines into people's arms. They would bring this up at every hearing. They would say, why aren't we getting the vaccines faster to residents? What can Maryland be doing? What can Maryland be learning from other states, for instance, such as West Virginia, that we could be doing better to get vaccines to people? And the response from the state has generally been, actually, we're doing a pretty good job. We're using the majority of the vaccines that we have. And a reluctance to sort of adapt what other states are doing. A recurring demand from state lawmakers has been, we need a centralized website where people don't have to, you know, go to multiple different websites and make multiple different appointments. And that's something that Secretary Schrader and Governor Larry Hogan have repeatedly pushed against.
Yeah, their contention is that the states that have tried that haven't done very well with it, and those websites crash, and they seem to have a difference of opinion as to whether or not that's, in fact, the advisable way to go. In the last few minutes that we have, Sarah Kim, you did a wonderful story about a local doctor. You met him back in the summer. His name is David Meyer, or Mayer, forgive me if I'm pronouncing it wrong. Talk about what he did to raise awareness about these concerns.
Yeah, so Dr. David Mayer, he's a CEO of the Patient Safety Movement Foundation, I believe. And he came to Baltimore to Camden Yards last July. And basically, over the past year, since February of 2020, he started this walk. And his goal was to go to all of the Major League Baseball stadiums in America and do a walk across the country. He was inspired by Forrest Gump, and he said he wanted to run initially, but his knees aren't quite set out for that. So he walked to eventually 20 of these stadiums, and he's planning to walk to the rest in the coming months. And at every stadium he's been at, he's talked about how people who've lost loved ones to medical error have walked with him, and it's helped him bring attention to this important issue. He said he's finished phase one of his walk, and in the coming months, he's planning to go to DC and talk to legislators there about what can be done to reduce medical error-related deaths. And his goal and his movement's goal is to by 2030 for there to be zero medical error-related deaths, which is quite ambitious given that it's one of the most common causes of death in the United States.
Indeed. And of course, he has an emphasis not only on the patients who are suffering because of errors, but the caregivers of patients. And of course, with so many people suffering from diseases like COVID, there are a number of caregivers that are really under a lot of stress. So it was a great story that you did, and we appreciate it. Sarah Y. Kim is our health and housing reporter here at WIPR, and you can find a link to all of the stories by Sarah and John Lee and Emily Sullivan and the entire WIPR news team at WIPR.org. Sarah, thank you so much. Appreciate it, and look forward to your continued reporting.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow here on Midday, a conversation with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Letitia Geraza, plus the best-selling author Anne Lamott joins me to talk about her latest book. It's called Dusk, Night, Dawn, on Revival and Courage. So now let's check in again with our program director and the host of our jazz show, Andy Beanstock. Andy, it is the first day of our spring membership campaign, and you and I both want to thank the folks who have made a pledge to help us kick things off so far.
Absolutely. Thank you to everyone who has made a pledge to WYPR, and thanking you for choosing to spend some of your day with WYPR. If you already support us financially, we get you that extra thanks. Public radio, you know, is member-supported radio. Everything you hear on WYPR, from breaking news to in-depth analysis to compelling conversations, it's all paid for by listener support. If you have not yet made a pledge, please do it now on this first day of our spring pledge drive. Visit WYPR.org and click the donate link to get started.